Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Ed Coyle. Ed is the executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans, a progressive organization for senior citizens. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about the origins and the agenda of the ARA.
The Alliance for Retired Americans is an organization that was formed in 2001 for retired Americans and to educate and advocate on their behalf. We have grown now to over 3 million members over the last 4 years. We are opening chapters in all 50 states. We are organized in about 25 of the states thus far. And we're created to be a full-time organization advocating for seniors.
How are you different from the AARP, which is one of the largest voluntary organizations in the world and the largest of the senior organizations in the states?
Well, AARP, first of all, is not a political organization. We do grassroots organizing and political advocacy. We run campaigns with our members, asking them to vote for or against a specific candidate. We are not an organization like AARP that does benefits, and we're really more of an advocacy organization. While they're selling benefits and insurance products to their folks, as well as taking positions on issues, the most glaring thing difference between the two of us, between the Alliance for Retired Americans and AARP, is our position on some issues. The AARP, of course, supported the president's prescription drug legislation for Medicare in 2003, and the Alliance for Retired Americans led the fight against it.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that was big news this week, that the budget estimate for how much that benefit was going to cost, which no one seems to have understood when they put it into place in the first place, is now been increased by, 70%?
Well, you know, it started at $400 billion, and which was the law that the president signed in, or the bill that the president signed into law, was $400 billion. Then they said almost immediately that it was actually going to cost $537 billion. And the actuary for the department that has administrative responsibility for the law actually said that he knew that it was going to cost more than the $400 billion. And they told him that in the department that if he said anything publicly about it, they would fire him. So the bill passed by one vote. Now all of a sudden, it's jumped up to, by someone's estimate, $1.2 trillion. The administration admits to $727 billion. But the sad thing is that whether it's $400 billion or $1.2 trillion, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, which is to help seniors with their rising medical costs every year. If someone had told me back in 2003, this thing is going to cost $1.2 trillion, we could have actually put in place a real benefit for seniors. It would not have been a handout to the pharmaceutical industry or to the insurance industry. It would have really gotten some kind of relief for seniors who have to face prescription drug bills rising every month of their lives. So the whole thing is a joke. It doesn't get anything to seniors. It just pays back insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry.
You know, one of the kind of catch-22s of being a progressive activist in the States is that all of these half measures, these liberal reforms, or in this case a reform put in place by conservatives, they balloon up in their costs, and then the conservatives say, well, we can't go any further. We can't have single payer or something like that, because that would just be even more costly. And actually, it's quite the reverse.
I mean, the sad thing about this bill, which I think at one point there were some folks on the Hill, I think Republicans and Democrats, who really did have the best interests of seniors in mind when the thing began. Sadly, sadly that it became so partisan as it did, most Republicans sided with the president, who ultimately decided that he was going to pass a piece of legislation that really did nothing for a whole lot of seniors. The thing that bothered me the most was that the president of the United States and the Speaker of the House of Representatives on several occasions said specifically, this is all you're going to get. This is the best we're going to offer. Take it or leave it. And the Speaker Hastert said that several times, actually said it to groups of people, take it or leave it. And seniors are smart enough to know that the president who said take it or leave it and that speaker who said take it or leave it knew that, in fact, people could get cheaper drugs if they went to Canada. and as people are still doing, even though they've made it against the law. But they said to the seniors, we're not going to allow you to do that, even though I know you could get cheaper drugs up there. Then they said to seniors, we also know if we would use the power of the federal government to negotiate prices with pharmaceuticals, we also know that we could get you cheaper prices that way, but we're not going to do that either. So what they essentially did was say, here it is, take it or leave it, and the lion's share of the money is going to the president's friends in the pharmaceutical industry.
So you think that the principal problem here is that corporations convinced the Bush administration not to allow the kinds of cost controls and expeditious government purchasing practices that we really should have had in that bill?
There is no cost control. And if you ever needed a specific example, all you had to do was to look at what they proposed as a kind of a interim program between the time the thing was passed and the time it goes into effect in January of 2006, and that's these so-called discount cards, which are a joke. I mean, first of all, everyone's seen through them. No one's even applying for them. Those who have applied for them and gotten them have found that they can pay their premium, which is on average about $35 a month, and they can make the judgment about which card's best for them based on what drugs they're taking, and they can start and they can commit to $420 a year in monthly payments. But the pharmaceutical company doesn't have to commit to keep the drug that they had originally signed up for on the list of things that they get the discount for. And the pharmaceutical company has the right to change offered drugs every 7 days, which is just unbelievable. So that if you sign up for Plan A and you've got, you know, these drugs which you have to take and you think you're going to get this discount next week, what the drugs that are on Plan A may have been taken off Plan A and you're just stuck.
Let's talk for a second about the Social Security. Well, not for a second. Let's talk a lot about the Social Security shell game that's going on. What is the alleged crisis that the Bush administration is pointing to, and what's the ARA's perspective on whether there is going to be eventually a Social Security crisis?
Well, you know, the president has been using the word crisis for a very long time. If you notice lately, he has stopped using the word crisis and has started talking about a problem. No one denies that the Social Security program needs some fixing, some adjustments, some strengthening process. The fact of the matter is that the president's words and the program that he lays out, the law that he would like to see pass, is a total overreaction to what the situation is. If nothing happened, if nothing happened on either side, if the Social Security stayed just as it is for the next 40 years, a worker who's probably on his or her first job in mid-20s to late-20s would still be collecting 100% of his or her Social Security when they retire 35, 40 years from now. That's just a fact. It wouldn't be around much longer after that, but everybody who is on Social Security, paying into Social Security now, who's in their 30s, would have at least 5 to 10 years when they retire to where they could collect Social Security. Now, no one's suggesting that we do that, but that is hardly a crisis. The president's suggestion offer is that we take what is amount of income that we know is dwindling in Social Security, and rather than strengthening it, we take a couple $1 trillion out of it. He says there's a problem with Social Security, that there's a day coming we're not going to be able to fund it. And his first response to that is to say to younger workers, well, you don't have to pay as much into Social Security. And then to say to older folks and people who are already on Social Security that we're going to do this, we're going to take younger workers' money out, and we're going to borrow $2 trillion from a foreign country to make sure that this transition goes okay. So it makes no sense. And I think what you're seeing on the Hill, and I know members of Congress and Senate in your area are having some second thoughts about supporting this president's President Bush's plan. What you see on the Hill is a major back off on the part of specifically some Republican members of the House who have taken a look at this, realize it's not going to fly, realize it's terribly dangerous for them politically, just from a crass political point of view, but it's just not good policy.
Well, this crisis, this alleged crisis, is and the problems of Social Security that might crop up in the future are part of an international situation that we face because of the growing longevity of seniors. And so in Japan and in Europe, there's a similar kind of concern about the pensions of old people and whether there are going to be sufficient number of young workers to support the elderly. Does the ARA think that this notion that the Americans have of a savings account where we put it, our money into this Social Security savings account and then we take it back out. Is this really the right way to go, or should we be thinking more in terms of a decent level of social provision for everyone when they need it?
Well, the one thing we don't have to do is panic. There is plenty of time, and we've been urging, the Alliance for Retired Americans has been urging members of Congress to just take a couple steps back, realize that this doesn't have to be crammed through in this session of Congress or even the next session of Congress. You know, let's put together a real group of people who are going to look at it and make judgments that are best for the long-term interest of the country and seniors who are going to be dependent on this in the future. When Ronald Reagan was president, certainly no wild-eyed liberal, and when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, certainly no right-wing conservative. The two of them worked together on a commission back in the early 80s, which in fact was a bipartisan commission, which in fact made some recommendations that Reagan, with the support of Democrats in Congress, passed and signed into law. President Bush, in creating his own commission in the early part of his first term, appointed people to the commission where there was absolutely no difference of opinion. There were Democrats on the commission, but every single person on that commission supported privatization. So, what? Of course, he's going to get a recommendation for privatization from that committee because they all went in supporting privatization. Our thought now is to recreate what President Reagan did, and that's to have a group of people look again. It's been almost 20 years since that commission. Well, it's been 20 years since that commission did its work. Let's look again. Let's look again and see what recommendations could come forth. Let's take a look at all the things that the Reagan Commission did. Members of Congress on both sides are saying everything is on the table. A growing number of members on both sides, however, are saying no privatization. Now, should we have private accounts? Yeah, everyone should be, hopefully everybody's investing in private accounts, but it doesn't have to be at the expense of your Social Security tax.
I'm speaking with Ed Coyle. He's the executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans, which is at retiredamericans.org, isn't it?
It's www.retiredamericans.org.
There we go. Let's talk for a second about Medicare. Part of the picture here is the actuarial assumptions around how long people are going to live and how much of the benefits they're going to be able to take advantage of. And when Social Security was created, the actuarial cut point, I guess, was 65. The average life expectancy was 65. So only about half of all workers eventually took advantage of Social Security, and now many more than that do. Part of that plays into also Medicare, because if people live longer, they could potentially have much more longer and more costly illnesses at the end of the life. But what we've actually seen is seniors getting healthier. So I don't know if ARA has a position on this, but what's your personal opinion? What's going to happen if older people do get a lot healthier and live a lot longer? How are we going to have to adjust to that?
Well, the Medicare program is much greater danger than the Social Security program. Ironically, the president's focused so much on Social Security, taking people's attention away from Medicare, which is where the real crisis is. The president hasn't proposed anything. There are lots of folks, I think, in the Congress who are ready to talk about it, because you're absolutely right. There is a growing problem with Medicare, and at some point sooner than Social Security, it's going to become, to quote the president, a crisis. But the president is not looking at that. I think the issue of people living longer, people presumably working longer at some point, needs to be looked at in terms of the future of Medicare much more rapidly than the future of Social Security.
And again, the problem with Medicare, a lot of it could be traced back to the fact that we don't have very good control over health care costs general in our country.
That's right. I mean, the basic thing for both the prescription drug bill that the president signed a couple of years ago and the Medicare program just in general is that there's nothing that really can save it ultimately unless there's some effort to control the cost of health care, the cost of prescription drugs, because it's just going to keep going up and up and up until no government program can save it.
Does ARA support single payer or the extension of Medicare to all Americans?
We have supported single payer. It's not something, obviously, that's going to come out of this Congress. I think our mission in electing a Congress, and we were very active in the last both the presidential campaign and the 2004 congressional elections. Our effort there was to elect a Congress that was senior friendly and would, in fact, take a serious look at all aspects of our health care system, including single payer. Would we like to see single payer? Yes. Do we think that it's going to come out of this current Congress or maybe even the next Congress? No. But that would be our goal.
One of the reasons why I'm interested in this issue, I'm 44 years old, but back when I was 25 in graduate school, I joined the Gray Panthers because when I started to study bioethics, there was this debate at the time about intergenerational equity and solidarity and these issues. And there is going to be increasing tension between the growing population of seniors and younger workers about taxation and redistribution of money from workers to seniors. One of the reasons why we might want to create a single payer system is because it would overcome some of the tensions if we were all in the same pot instead of having to have younger workers fund Medicare, which is only for old folks.
You know, one of the really sad offshoots of this debate about private accounts is the consequence, the inevitable consequence of it, is that the younger you are, the less you believe that you're actually going to get Social Security. So if you never believe you're going to get it, why put the money into it when you can have the right to take the money and invest it in something else or something that your neighbor says is a good idea? So that's a sad consequence of this, because Social Security, as you know, has always been one generation helping the next one up. And in fact, it's worked for 70 years. The Social Security, which is important to note, there's never been a Social Security check that bounced, never, in 70 years of the program. It's one of the most efficiently run administratively programs that's ever existed. 1% of the total budget of the Social Security Administration goes to administrative costs. The rest goes in checks to people. So it's a program that works. It's a program that we know that has worked, that people are comfortable with, that people like, that they understand, that they've been investing in for all of their working life. They're comfortable. Obviously, the older you are, the more comfortable you are that you're going to get your Social Security check. But there's no reason why this program can't be looked at very closely in a way that makes younger workers much more assured that they're going to get the check when they retire, and stop creating such a doubt in their mind that it will have the end result of doing what you suggested, which is pitting a younger generation against an older generation who they think are stealing their money.
You work closely.
But,
go ahead.
By the way, one thing that, on that topic too. I mean, you know, a lot of people have always thought Social Security, the elderly or older Americans. This is a different worry for each segment of the population. I mean, clearly people who are on Social Security right now have been assured by the president that they're not in trouble. They can collect the check as long as they're alive. We're not convinced that that's right based on the economy and what the president's program will do to the overall economy, number one. Number two, then there are the people who were in your age group and my age group who have put 25, 30 years into the Social Security system, who are still 10 or 15 years away from their retirement, who have got to be looking at borrowing this $2 trillion that it's going to take, and not just worrying about whether, in fact, we can pay it back if we borrow it, particularly from China or Japan, which is the most likely place we would borrow it, but what is it going to do to the overall economy? I mean, if you've got, you know, 30 years worth of taxes having gone into your own Social Security, but you have to work another 10 years, and you know that at the end, during that 10-year process, the government intends to borrow $2 trillion just as the Social Security system is running low on money, you have to worry as well. And, of course, the younger workers who have got not much money invested yet but who are 35 or 40 years away from retirement, you know, justifiably wonder whether it's going to be there for them at all. The problem is that the younger workers are being told, well, here's the Social Security system is over here. By the way, the Social Security system check for you is not guaranteed anymore at all because we're taking so much money out of Social Security that it's less likely that it'll be there when you retire. So here's a little bit of your Social Security money being saved and guaranteed over here, and here's this other money over here that you can invest, and you can invest it, obviously, at your own discretion. There's no guarantee at all that you're going to have any of that money when you retire because it is by nature an investment which is risky. So young folks have to be worried about it as well for this very reason.
You, at the Alliance for Retired Americans, you work closely with the labor movement, and one of the problems that the labor movement has always had is that because we don't have a strong social safety net here in the United States, people have fought for benefits through the through their employment. Mm-hmm. And, well, I see that as a problem because I wish that we had put more energy over the last 100 years into fighting for general benefits. But now those benefits, those workplace benefits, retiree health benefits in particular, and pensions seem to be in crisis. Is this part of your agenda as well?
And it absolutely is. I mean, you know, retirement security, you know, really, in addition to Social Security, retirement security meaning that you're going to get the pension that you always believed that you were going to get, that your health care costs, your drug costs won't skyrocket so much that it affects your quality of life, and that obviously you're getting the Social Security check that you've always expected to get. So the retirement security, just in general, is something that the Alliance for Retired Americans is strongly focused on. You're right to point out that an awful lot of, well, union contracts, but also other non-union corporations that have offered retiree benefits to their employees are now very much in question. On the prescription drug issue alone, we've seen corporations that have said, well, we did give you prescription drug retiree coverage, but we're going to take it back now because you don't have to worry about it because of this new prescription drug law that the president has signed, which is all you need. Well, of course, in most cases, the new law is far less than what they would have gotten under a company's retirement package, retiree package. So that is definitely a major issue for us, and it should be something that all Americans think about, current retirees, but again, people who were in our age demographic who were 10 years away and don't know that everything's going to be there as they planned now, particularly union contracts, because union contracts have very much been of the last 20 years been less demanding of salary increases and more demanding of health care increases. So union contracts in particular are very vulnerable to this.
So in the short term now, we've got this Republican hegemony in Washington. Are you excited by the ascension of Howard Dean and some of the new thinking that seems to be stirring in activist Democratic circles that we might be able to rebuild a progressive movement and push some of this back over the next couple of years?
Well, you know, I was lucky enough to be able to spend some time the last couple of days over at the meeting of the Democratic National Committee. And there is a genuine energy that's kind of retaken the party. Obviously, everyone was upset at the results of the election back in November, and all not just because you know our candidate lost, but because of all the issue dreams that we had and things that we wanted to increase, things that we wanted to change, things we wanted to eliminate. Obviously, are now waiting another 4 years, and I do sense it in the both in the party, but more importantly for the Alliance for Retired Americans and our members around the country. We are, you asked earlier about AARP, our main difference with AARP, other than the sometimes difference we have on issues, is that we are a true grassroots organization. We have 3 million members, 3 million members who live outside the Beltway. So we got members in every state. We have members in every congressional district. We obviously stay in touch with all of them through our own organization. And I can tell you, while we went through about 2 or 3 weeks with people really being really down, from November the 3rd through the holidays, people are back up. They're ready to fight on the Social Security issue, and I think in time they'll be ready to fight another congressional campaign in 2006.
Ed, I really want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Ed Coyle. He's the executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans, which is at retiredamericans.org.
Thanks very much.
Regular listeners to Change Surfer Radio know that I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I thought I would share this recent posting by Jody Paulson that was posted at radioforall.net. And this is just a short piece that Jody wanted to share with the world about the mysterious deaths of microbiologists.
Hi, this is Jody Paulson from Moscow, Idaho, with What They Don't Tell You. I don't like the news I'm about to tell you. I think it provokes fear and perhaps a feeling of helplessness. But the thugs behind this news are like vampires. They can only operate in the dark. It is my sincere hope that someone will connect the dots in these cases, and those dots point to a perpetrator that can be apprehended and dealt with. The lives of untold numbers of people may be at stake. That being said, nearly 24 of the world's leading microbiologists have been found dead under mysterious circumstances after the first U.S. anthrax attacks in 2001. In just 2 months, November and December 2001, Benito Kay, who specialized in infectious diseases, was found beaten to death outside his laboratory. Former Soviet bioweapons expert Vladimir Pasechnik died of a reported stroke. Leading DNA sequencing researcher Robert Schwartz was found stabbed to death. Microbiologist Seth Van Nguyen died in an airtight storage lab filled with deadly nitrogen. World-renowned biochemist Don Wiley's car was found in the middle of the Mississippi River Bridge with the engine running. 35 days later, Dr. Wiley's body was fished out of the river, 300 miles south of where he vanished. Incidentally, the Memphis coroner, O.C. Smith, the man who performed the autopsy on Wiley, was soon after found lying in a stairwell, wrapped in barbed wire, with a live bomb strapped to his chest. Smith, who survived the attack, declines to talk about it. Then in February and March, 2002, the head of the Russian State Medical University Microbiology Lab, Viktor Korshunov, was found dead of blunt head injuries in the entrance of his house. No arrests, no suspects. Microbiologist Ian Langford, an expert in environmental risks and disease, was found dead at his blood-spattered, ransacked home, his body naked from the waist down and partly wedged under a chair. Again, no arrests, no suspects. Dr. Tanya Holtzmeier, who had co-invented a tool that has helped find hundreds of molecular targets to combat cancer and HIV, was found shot to death at her front door by a former colleague, who then immediately killed himself. Case closed. The only witness was a pizza delivery man who worked for a non-existent pizza place. David Wynn Williams, an award-winning microbiologist, was killed after being struck by a vehicle while jogging. The very next day, Stephen Mostow, one of the country's leading experts on infectious disease, died in a small plane crash. The list goes on. I've only described 4 months for you folks. And let's not forget the suicide of microbiologist David Kelly, source of BBC reports that actual information on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction did not support government conclusions used to justify the war in Iraq. Dr. Kelly was Britain's leading expert on Baghdad's weapons programs and one of the world's most renowned microbiologists. Could any of these mysterious deaths be connected? Who would want these people dead? Did the leading experts on microbiology and disease pose some sort of threat to someone with either their knowledge or expertise? I don't know, but something's fishy. Author Steve Quayle alleges that 40 microbiologists have died under suspicious circumstances in the past 4 years, most specializing in vaccines or bioweapons research. Thanks to GatorPress.com/BadSam for much of the information for this commentary. I'm Jody Paulson, and I just thought you should know.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.